The final case for oral argument this morning is the Public Entity Pool for Liability versus David Score et al. And Tamara Wagaman. For the appellant is Rita Allen, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee is Brent Wilburn, an attorney from Pier. A couple of things we should note for the record. This is actually a case that was set for the October term, and therefore the October term panel was brought back for this hearing. Also, Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Thomas Trimble, the presiding judge of the Seventh Circuit, to sit in his place. And Ms. Allen, you may proceed.
May it please the Court. Mr. Aberesk represented Tamara Wagaman in the declaratory judgment action below, and Mr. Aberesk and I represent Mrs. Wagaman in this appeal. On July 21, 1999, Tamara Wagaman was a youth counselor at the training school. She was training to be a group leader at the state training school in Plankinton. At that time, Gina Score was a 14-year-old who had been placed in the intensive program at Plankinton. On the morning of July 21, 1999, Ms. Wagaman, Raylene Lane, who would be her superior, who was a group leader, and Roxanne Fry supervised about a 2.5-mile walk jog in which Gina Score participated. At the walk started around 7. There was some warm-up. At about 7:45, Gina Score announced that she could no longer proceed. She sat down, then she lay down. This was about 500 yards from where the jog walk was to end. She was encouraged by all of the staff and all the students to continue. Raylene Lane called the registered nurse that had been hired, Meredy Fett, who came as soon as she got there to work shortly after around 8 o'clock. Fett stayed until about 8:30. She thought that Gina Score was hyperventilating. The staff and the students thought that it was self-induced hyperventilation. In any event, at around 8:45 to 9 o'clock, Gina Score got up and walked around 200 yards and then sat down and did not get up again. Lane, again, contacted the registered nurse at around 10 o'clock. And also, Raylene Lane, who again would be Wagaman's, would be higher in rank than Wagaman, did go to Ramsey, Claire Ramsey, who was the superintendent of the school, and to Mr. Johnson, who was program manager. And they were advised, and they advised that they should wait her out. Again, the nurse came back again, and eventually a physician's assistant was called, who then determined that an ambulance should be called, and Gina Score died after having cardiac arrest in that ambulance. The investigator for the People's Fund, Jarris, wrote in his first report that after talking to Clay Ramsey, again, who was the superintendent of that school, that Ramsey feels that the employees did everything expected of them. All activities performed, including the encouragement along the run, would be considered normal protocol. And Jarris concluded in that first report that I do not find any activities outside the scope and the realm of employment, and I believe that coverage would be afforded to all the state employees. He also opined that the biggest exposure was to the registered nurse and her employer. In any event, Governor Janklow has testified in a deposition that he ordered fired, and I quote him, the ones I felt were responsible after reading the Attorney General report. Tamara Wagaman was fired from her position on August 20th of 1999. On January 21st, 2000, an information was filed against her, charging her with four counts of child abuse. The trial judge had refused to bind over the manslaughter charge. The cases against her, Lane was also charged criminally, proceeded to trial. And on October 19th, 2000, Wegeman was acquitted of all the charges. Lane was likewise acquitted of all charges, criminal charges against her. In October 28th, 1999, a couple of months after Gina Score died, her father and guardian brought an action in federal district court for wrongful death and civil rights violations. At that time, the People's Fund defended under a reservation of rights all of the state employees. So that would be Johnson, Ramsey, Ettinger, and Frey, but chose not to defend Lane and Wegeman and did not defend them under a reservation of rights or otherwise. And on November 22nd of 1999, this declaratory judgment action was brought, and it brought the issue of whether the People Fund had an obligation to
defend. So this case only involves a defense in the federal fund?
Yes.
Okay. Federal, in the federal lawsuit?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it did, and then an answer and counterclaim, and then a second answer and counterclaim were filed, and Wegeman requested attorney fees on the declaratory judgment action based on contract and statutory theories.
But still represents a case involving representation in a civil action, nothing that had to do with the criminal cases.
That's correct. Yeah. It was.
So that's where we're at.
Definitely.
Was she entitled to be represented at that time?
Right. And then with the counterclaim, was she entitled in a motion also for attorney fees for the attorney fees on the declaratory judgment action? On the issue of whether the People Fund had an obligation to defend Wegeman, the trial court made its determination in favor of Wegeman at a hearing on March 29th and later, I think, a memorandum opinion in June of 2001. And in December of 2002, ruled in favor of People on Wegeman and the People Fund's motions for summary judgment on the counterclaim for attorney fees on the declaratory judgment action. And Wegeman is appealing from that order and from earlier orders, the one which imposed terms against her counsel on the motion for discovery on subpoenaing the records of the Johnson Heideprim firm and also on the denial of the order for terms on the motion to compel regarding Governor Janko's deposition.
I take it that Raylene Lane did not prevail on the claim for attorney's fees and the declaratory action either.
I don't believe so. And in fact, I am not certain what issues were raised, what was briefed, and to what extent that she pursued that.
Obviously, she hasn't decided not to pursue it on appeal.
Obviously, yes. I have not heard anything at any stage of this game. We contend that the attorney fees are justified on the defense of the declaratory judgment based on the breach of contract. And the contract we're referring to is the Memorandum of Liability Coverage to the Employees of the State of South Dakota. And that is attached to the initial brief. And in that memorandum to the employees of the state of South Dakota, People Fund agreed to provide both damage coverage and defense coverage. And regarding the defense coverage, that memorandum defines defense costs. As all fees and expenses generated by and related to the adjustment, investigation, defense, or litigation of a claim, including attorney's fees, court costs, and interest on judgment before they are paid. The only exclusion on the defense costs were defense costs that included salaries and overhead of employees of the state of South Dakota.
She did get her attorney. I mean, she did receive, at least after the circuit court ordered it, so. She did get all the expenses and defense costs of her of the claim against her.
Of the claim.
Of the claim against her.
I don't disagree. And if that definition only dealt with the claim, and it could have, very easily could have, people, I assume, wrote this, and if you wanted to restrict those defense costs to just the defense of the claim, you axe out about two lines on this, and you say the fees and expenses for the defense or litigation of a claim.
Well, what you're wanting now is the attorney fees that your client incurred in getting the defense under the agreement in the federal court. You're saying that she is entitled to not only what was expended there, but that she's also entitled to what was expended to recover that.
Definitely.
Because as I understand it, there was no defense for her provided by the fund in the federal court.
Not
is that
until
right?
Really.
Or am I wrong?
You initially, no, there wasn't any. You're right. And then when the court made its ruling, which, of course, was after the case had been dismissed, it did order fees for that.
Dismissed?
Yes.
It was settled?
It was settled and then
yes.
Dismissed,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so it was no longer paid.
She was not part of that settlement. She's not named in the settlement. Neither is Lane, but
the
whole
case
was
still going against her?
No. Was dismissed. She's just not part of the settlement agreement.
But she was sued, but she didn't contribute in any way to the settlement.
No. Nor could she. But what I'm saying is there's a broader definition of costs than fees and expenses just for the defense of the litigation of the claim. If that's all they wanted to provide, that's easy enough to define it as such. That's not how they defined it. They defined it as fees and expenses generated by and related to. And it is hard to imagine how one could say that the defense of a declaratory judgment action on the duty to defend is not generated by and is not related to the defense or litigation of the claim, which is under the memorandum agreement. Again, they wrote this agreement. They wrote the definition. That is the definition of defense costs that they have. I don't believe there's anything ambiguous about that. It is broad enough, generated by, related to. But if there were any ambiguity under the Olson case, and if there's any ambiguity, the interpretation most favorable to the insured should be adopted. And that interpretation would be, since you have to have a declaratory judgment action to even get the fees and expenses for the claim in federal court, that definitely those attorney fees that were expended on that declaratory judgment being brought in as a defendant should be covered under that definition of defense costs.
Do you think, maybe this is a little argumentative, but I was going to ask you, do you think that what you've just read to us is modified by the fact that you're dealing only with defense costs?
Not when you go back to just the basic definition under defense coverage. And it does talk about the defense costs of being payable in addition to the coverage limit. So I think the entire agreement refers to that and says that this is covered. I don't think
you know, a lot of times attorney fees are statutory or something like that, unless it's provided for by agreement. So you're saying the agreement provides for it.
The agreement does provide it in unambiguous terms.
But the agreement provides for a defense, and that's what the trial court said. That the fund should defend her in the federal claim.
Okay. But the agreement provides for more than that. It talks about in relation to and generated by. Those terms extended that. So to the first part, the trial judge ruled correctly. It was at the end of it on the fees for the declaratory judgment action. Also,
then she did get some fees.
She did get some fees.
Yeah. Okay. And that, is that in front of us now? I haven't seen it. Okay.
No. And the People Fund did not appeal from that adverse decision on the defense in the federal action. Also, this is a matter of summary judgment, and Wegman contends that there were genuine issues of material fact that precluded that summary judgment in Wegman's claims for attorney fees under 58.12.3, and on the issue of whether the People's Fund conduct was vexatious and without reasonable cause. And again, since it's summary judgment, you view the facts in the light most favorable to Wegman, and you would give her all reasonable inferences.
That has to do with that's in the insurance part of Code 58, right? Is the People Fund covered by that? Do they have to file everything like insurance companies do in that?
Yes, and this court has said that it's a practical matter that you apply for general principles of insurance to the people fund.
What case was that in again?
That would be... people fund is the one that it was cited in. Again, when you look at the due diligence in the Wagner's paper, and you look at the issue about reasonable cause and vexatious, first of all, start out with their own investigator. People fund's own investigator said that there were no activities outside their employment, the realm of their employment, said that there should be coverage, quoted Ramsey as saying these people did everything they were supposed to do. If you look at the rules and what they followed, the actual conduct that day, I mean, these are people, especially Wagaman, she is about the bottom of the heap in terms of chain of command, which was extremely important, in terms of making policy, deciding whether policy be modified, or even deciding whether there was going to be a run that day and whether you followed that run. And what happened is she went to her supervisor, who goes to their supervisors, Ramsey and Johnson, who say, wait it out. Take it to the medical side, go to the nurse not once, but twice, who doesn't say move, who doesn't say anything, that brings out paper bags and sits there.
How does this relate to the issue before us?
Well, because whether you decided not to give them coverage, whether that was vexatious or without reasonable cause.
Is there like a bad faith claim?
Yes, there is a bad
faith. So you're saying there's genuine issue of material fact as far as whether or not it was bad faith?
Right. To deny the coverage for the attorney fees, because under that definition that's broad enough to involve the declaratory judgment action. Again, look at how...
Just for clarification now, since we've raised this issue of bad faith. As I understand it, though, you're the bad faith or the vexatious claim you're making is pursuant to 58.12.3.
Yes.
You're making a separate tort claim.
Not unless it be in the context of the statutory provisions of the Declaratory Judgment Act. But right now what I'm discussing is 58.12.3, and that's just to look at the vexatious or without reasonable cause. Then if you look at the fact that they defended other people who were more culpable, people higher up who could make the policy, who could modify it, who could tell them to do something but stand there and wait it out. When you look at that, it is a very reasonable inference to say this is scapegoating. And scapegoating falls within vexatious or without reasonable cause. When you look at how this decision was made, there was no consultation with the Attorney General as is contemplated under the statute. And with all due respect to the people who made the decision in this case, they could benefit by scapegoating. They could benefit most by scapegoating. Mr. Wilbur was both attorney for the People Fund, the attorney for Governor Janklow, and the attorney for Bloomberg. It is in their interest, it would always be in their interest, to cast the blame on someone else and to say that these people are not worthy of representation.
You've given us all these facts, and I assume that was what you put in some form, yes, to the trial court.
Yes.
And he says there's no genuine issue of material fact, and I don't know, you know, what the dispute was or anything. I haven't looked at it. But now, what are you saying that he did when he erred in making this decision?
Well, in summary judgment, you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and you give them all reasonable inferences. When you look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party...
How were the facts presented to the trial court? An argument, or was there affidavits, depositions, and everything there that he would look that would show these facts? That's all I'm asking you.
A combination of both. The depositions, the Attorney General report, which you would have at the time that the briefing was done, as this court knows, there were a lot of the depositions and such attached. I later moved to have those be part of the record here because they were certainly before the court at that time. But yes, the court did consider all those matters. And when you look at all of those things, process and the timing of it. This woman is fighting her termination, is fighting the criminal case, is fighting the federal case, and bring the declaratory judgment action. Basically, their determination on this matter, there are certainly genuine issues of material fact that it was vexatious and without reasonable cause.
Vexatious and that without reasonable cause kind of sounds in tort, doesn't it?
Well, It would, but it is the language that is employed in 58.12.3, and that's what the court has looked at, and that's the standard that they've applied.
So I'm asking, are you saying that this is the type of case that is more appropriate for on the merits, as we said,
than on summary judgment? Is that what you're saying? This is, and you review this record, that's what this cries out for, or what?
Under 58.12.3, that's correct. I believe under looking at the contract itself, the court should have looked at that contract and said that that language is broad enough. And if there's any ambiguity, which I don't believe there is, construed it against the insurer.
In some cases, there can be a reasonable basis for making a different decision. You know, I think it says, sometimes even says that in insurance cases.
Sure.
You know, is there a reasonable basis for making the decision? Was that shown to the trial court what the basis was?
Not that I can see. When you look at everybody's conduct, when you look at the level of culpability, when you look at who was responsible, when you look at their own adjuster, when their own investigator says these people did everything they should do and they should be covered, what is your reasonable basis? Other than you got in a room, people who had an interest in this and decided we're going to shut these people out because we're offended by their conduct. That raises the other issue. When you look at the terms that were imposed against Mr. Aberesk, in the Chittenden case, when you impose terms, the court's supposed to consider the equities. When you, I believe my time is out.
Your time has expired.
And I would say that the equities of someone who was representing someone was not getting paid. It was all a question.
Your time has expired.
Mr. Wilbur, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Brent Wilbur. I represent the public entity pool for liability in this matter. First, I'd like to clarify several things that were prompted by your questions of Ms. Allen. First of all, with response to, I believe, was Justice Konenkamp's question, Raylene Lane, through her attorney, did not seek the relief that's being sought here. Both Raylene Lane and Tamara Wegman had all of their costs and attorney's fees in the federal district court action paid as a result of Judge Rush's decision. And it is correct that the People Fund did not pay or did not appeal that payment. So the only thing that brings us here today is whether you are entitled to claim attorney's fees in a declaratory judgment action. In response to another question, I believe Justice Amundson asked Ms. Allen, is the People Fund insurance and do they have to file with the Commissioner of Insurance? And I think her answer was erroneous. They do not by statute. I think it's 3-22-7. Says the People Fund is not insurance and does not come under the purview of the Commissioner of Insurance.
It's sort of in place of. It's an insurance. Self-insured, it looks like to
actually,
me.
Actually, it is not a self-insured. This court in, I believe, the Kylo decision made reference in passing to the fact that it was a self-insurance scheme. What it really is a statutorily created pool for the indemnification of employees of the state of South Dakota and potentially other public entities.
It was formed rather than by insurance, because insurance was difficult to get back in those days when it was first formulated.
Well, for a while, the state was insured. For a while, the state relied on sovereign immunity after the high-grade oil case came out. Then the state had commercial insurance, and then the People Fund was adopted, and the state has had that ever since. But it's clear that the legislature has said, and I believe it binds you, that the People Fund is not insurance.
So it's somewhere between an absolute bar to suit and insurance. On one end, insurance, one end, sovereign immunity, and the People Fund somewhere in that middle?
The People Fund would be somewhere in the middle, but I think my point is that statutorily, it's clearly, there's been a declaration that it's not insurance, and I think that hinges on whether SDCL 58-12-3 applies.
Yes, that's what you're saying, 58. 12.3 doesn't apply because we aren't dealing with an insurance.
That's correct. One statute specifically, which is, I think, 322.7, specifically says this is not insurance and the insurance commissioner has no jurisdiction. If you look at 58.12.3, it specifically requires that a suit be based on any type or kind of insurance. And so we're dealing with a statute that simply is not applicable.
But the trial court didn't say it wasn't applicable, did it? I thought the trial court went ahead and decided the question of whether there was, in fact, really some conduct that justified payment of attorney's fees under that statute.
As a matter of fact, the trial court examined far more than was raised in the pleadings. One of the questions it had was, what was raised in the pleadings? And I read the second amended counterclaim this morning. They made two claims, one bad faith, without mentioning SDCL 58-12-3, and the other was breach of contract. So I would submit that those were the only two claims. Judge Rush went past that and looked past the pleadings and analyzed 58-12-3.
You seem to assume that 58-12-3, maybe it's just for the sake of argument, but he went ahead as if it did apply and made a determination that even if it did, she still wasn't entitled to attorney's fees.
Well, the issue of 58-12-3 was not briefed as extensively at the trial court as it was here simply because his wife had not raised it.
But he did. I think in his memorandum opinion, I read that he did cite it.
Oh, yes. There's no question. His opinion deals extensively with 58-12-3, and he did not address the issue as to whether 58-12-3 is insurance or not. But we have raised it, and we are entitled, I think, to raise any issue with regard to the summary judgment granted by the trial court.
But he didn't actually decide the issue, did he? I mean, as I read it, he just seemed to go ahead and assumed for the sake of argument that it applied and then decided that facts were not sufficient to grant relief even under that statute.
That's correct. He analyzed the bad faith claim and essentially concluded that a bad faith is a tort claim. This court has recognized that in several cases, and that the doctrine of sovereign immunity would apply.
And the tort issue is not even before us now because that issue hasn't been appealed. As I understand it, Ms. Wagaman is not asking us to apply a tort now. She's simply asking us to apply 58-12-3.
Frankly, I wasn't real clear from the brief. It appears to me they may well have abandoned the bad faith. But it was raised in their pleadings, and I wasn't sure from reading their brief.
Certainly, when I asked her just a moment ago, she indicated that their claim is twofold now. One is breach of contract, and one is under the statute.
Yes, I heard that. We had briefed, obviously, the bad faith issue because it was there.
With regard to the facts in this matter and how they were developed, depositions were taken in the district court case. Virtually all the depositions were taken for purposes of both cases. Deposition transcripts and numerous affidavits were filed. As a matter of fact, Mr. Abrest filed some 200 pages of material about 5 minutes before the last summary judgment hearing. So I think if you look at the record, it is huge.
Judge Rush found, looking at the facts, that the People Fund had a reasonable basis to deny coverage under the willful wanton exclusion, exclusion 30 in the People Fund coverage document. And there were facts there that support that. In looking at cases for the denial of coverage, you use a little bit different standard because, as this court said in the All Nation Insurance case, which went to the Supreme Court twice, the first time it went to the Supreme Court, the court said there could be an issue with regard to willful and vexatious. And then when it came back to the Supreme Court the second time, after the Circuit Court had made its decision, this court ruled that even though the Circuit Court had made facts, findings of fact, and even though they were supported by fact, the fact that there were other facts that could have been reasonably relied on by the insurance company in that case was enough to...
But if 58-12-3 isn't applied because we aren't insurance, how come we're talking about insurance?
Well, because I've been asked the questions.
No, but I mean, but you're saying that's the only thing
that is comparable to be a basis for whether or not there was a justifiable denial of the defense. And you have to look to other things because there isn't a lot of authority involving people funds around it. Area in the nation or whatever?
No, there is not. We would use a several part analysis. First, we believe it's clear that 58-12-3 doesn't apply to the People Fund because it's not insurance.
Second, even if you determine that it is insurance, if you look at the All Nations case, if the People Fund had, based on all the facts in the case, a reasonable basis to conclude that coverage should not be extended, then that action was justified. Even though there were facts cited by Ms. Allen that go the other way. So it isn't just whether there was a genuine issue of material fact, it's whether there were facts that could support the reasonable nature of the People Fund claim. That's how we would analyze that. And then we finally get to the fact that under the Kylo case, there's sovereign immunity, and there would be an issue as to whether 58-12-3 waives the sovereign immunity for the purpose of granting attorney's fees.
And Kylo also dealt with the ministerial discretionary things. That was a critical thing. Wasn't that the social worker that went through a stop sign on one of those and those cases like
that. That was the social worker through the stop sign case. That's correct. Yeah. But Kylo also said that the People Fund is subject to sovereign immunity and is not insurance. The case that was asked about earlier was the Winger case, in which you said that even though the People Fund isn't insurance, for general terms of construction of insurance contracts, you would apply the same standard that you would apply for an insurance company, to answer that question. Okay. We would submit that there's no contract here. They have pled a breach of contract, but in fact, there isn't any contract, and Judge Rush noted that also in his decision. They have not specifically in their brief laid out exactly what contract there is between the parties. There was no agreement. There was no premium. There was no written contract between the parties. The contract is between the state and the public entity pool for liability. That's the contract.
Well, if you go to work for the state of South Dakota,
are you told that part of the package is that you'll be defended by the People Fund?
No. I believe that you are specifically told that if you violate the policies and procedures of the state of South Dakota, that you will not be covered by the People Fund. I mean, that isn't in my brief. I think each state employee has to acknowledge that they've read the policies and procedures and has to follow. That was a key basis here. Wagaman and Lane had signed statements saying that they would follow the policies and procedures. And I believe, although it's not a record, I say that, I believe there are forms that they can be denied coverage if they don't follow those policies and procedures.
What policies and procedures did they fail to follow that the nurse followed?
The nurse wasn't a state employee. The nurse was an employee of Sioux Valley Hospital. So she wasn't, I mean, she worked, Sioux Valley Hospital had a contract with the state of South Dakota. The policies and procedures that they didn't follow are laid out in the affidavits of Judy Payne and Jeff Bloomberg. Judy Payne is the executive secretary of the People Fund. Jeff Bloomberg is the secretary of corrections. And the policies and procedures are laid out there. Their activities are laid out in various affidavits, various depositions, and in the report of the attorney general that's part of the record before you.
And that's their spin on it. But isn't that raise a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not that's in fact true?
It would, except that whether they violated those policies and procedures isn't an issue anymore. That would have been an issue.
Well, it was an issue if Judge Rush decided that there was a duty to defend in this particular case. The state agreed with the decision to appeal, so that all we're here for is whether attorney's fees
are capable of being assessed in a declaratory judgment action, and that's what Judge Rush ruled on. I think the issue is narrow.
So what you're saying is the issues in their pleadings are so narrow that they're out of court before they start. You're claiming they have no insurance claim because the statute's inapplicable, and you're claiming that there's no contract because this is something they're entitled to by statute as opposed to contract.
That would essentially be, yes.
We are saying that they're out of court, that they have no logical basis on which to prevail. And Judge Rush went through the analysis on each one of the claims that they had, and a well-reasoned opinion concluded that they did not. In a declaratory judgment action, it would appear that you can't collect attorney's fees unless there's either a clear contractual provision that you'd be allowed to do so,
or in the alternative,
that it's been a willful and vexatious refusal. And obviously we submit that
that wasn't the case here, and even if that statute was applicable, the facts didn't justify it in the judgment of the People Fund at the time.
And the People Fund provides coverage for people that are in line of their duties. And if they make a mistake, and it isn't, let's see, if it's discretionary, then there's sovereign immunity. If it's ministerial, there can be exposure, right, along that line.
That's correct. Yeah. There would be exposure for ministerial acts, but there's an exclusion to the People Fund coverage document that is unique to that document that does not appear in standard contracts of insurance. It's exclusion number 30, and it says that if a state employee is guilty of willful and wanton misconduct and in doing so violates state policies and procedures, there is no coverage under the People Fund. And so that was the issue.
It's similar, like there's no coverage for workers' comp if you're willful and wanton in doing something. So you're saying that is what was excluded here?
Yes.
Is that what the trial court said it wasn't? willful and wanton misconduct.
But the trial court said we had a duty to defend. Whether we had a duty to indemnify was never reached. Oh. The duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify, obviously. As soon as the trial court said we had a duty to defend, we paid for the defense, and we settled the claim against them so that they were, in fact, indemnified by the People Fund. We're only talking about attorney fees. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a South Dakota case that I
So can then just for my, and I'd be, in the settlement, it settled against all defendants. Even though they weren't involved in the settlement, the case was dismissed against them.
That's exactly correct. I helped draft the settlement document, which specifically settled all claims against Lane and Wagaman. And that case, this case went on after that, mainly because of the requests for attorney's fees. We would submit that there's not one South Dakota Supreme Court case in which, finally, attorney's fees and a declaratory judgment action were inflicted where there wasn't a showing of willful and vexatious conduct. And there is no clear contractual provision here that would provide for those attorney's fees. The term claims, if read in context, clearly goes to the claims being made against the city employee. We have to pay for that. There's nothing in that contract that says that we have to pay for declaratory judgment action attorney's fees. And the cases in other states that even go the other way say there has to be a clear contractual provision that would authorize the payment of those attorney's fees. That simply doesn't exist here.
And there's nothing in our declarations that you're saying as far as statutory authority, even in Declaratory Judgment Act, there's nothing in that act that provides for payment of attorney fees either?
No, I don't see anything in the Declaratory Judgment Act or in the section of the code dealing with breach of contract that would provide for attorney's fees. The rule, in fact, is just the opposite, as this court has reiterated on a number of occasions.
Unless it's there in a statute, you don't get it.
It's got to be there by statute or by agreement. And otherwise, it's just simply not there.
And you say there's no agreement here.
Yes, and that's correct. That summarizes our position.
What was the date of the settlement?
You've got me on that one. I think it was during the legislature in, I believe, 2001.
2001 or 2? 2000 or 2001?
2001, I believe.
So like a year and a half after the declaratory judgment action was started?
If I could clarify that by letter to the court, I would do it that way so that I'm exact. But that seems to be correct. I didn't know that was going to be an issue here, so I hadn't quite frankly thought about it.
Well, I don't know that it's an issue. It's just a statement of fact that I'd like to have.
Maybe your opponent will do that for too, but...
Okay, so you think it's during the legislative session of 2001, but you'll clarify it by letter.
And I will send a letter to the court clarifying the date that settlement became final.
Okay. Anything further?
I have nothing further on that issue unless the court wants to hear something from us on the issue of the assessment of attorney's fees against Mr. Aberesk by Judge Rush or with regard to the other issue that was raised, which are the claimed attorney's fees with regard to a motion to compel. Ms. Allen barely addressed the issue of Judge Rush's granting of sanctions against Mr. Aberesk. We would submit that a sanction of $350, given the facts of the activities of the parties, was abundantly justified. Judge Rush noted that this appeared to be some sort of political vendetta by Mr. Aberesk against the governor and his son. And I think if you look through the whole record in this case, and I'm sure you won't, because it would take you a long time, you would find that activity was not isolated. As a matter of fact, Judge Rush noted in his memorandum opinion that Mr. Aberesk had significantly misstated the facts with regard to at least one matter.
Well, correct. Is this the one where we had it set up before? It takes a while for an older mind to regenerate here. Is this the one? This is the case, isn't it, where they're asking for records of attorney fees from some law firm that isn't even involved in this case?
That's correct.
And so let me ask you this. If I want that, what in the world did they say it was relevant to as far as on the duty to defend?
Your Honor, I was on the telephone conference call hearing when Judge Rush asked Mr. Aberesk that question at least six times, continually saying, what is the relevance of Steve Johnson's partnership agreement with regard to the issues in this case? Mr. Aberesk totally
was unable to respond other than saying maybe Russ Jenkel got some of the money that his firm got for defending the U.S. District Court action for two of the state employee defendants.
Okay, then let me ask you this. If he did, what has that got to do with duty to defend?
I think that's what Judge Rush concluded, and that's one of the reasons he held that it was...
And you obviously argued it did.
That's right. Nobody but Mr. Abrus could figure out what relevance that could conceivably have. And finally, he admitted it was maybe to see if the governor's son got some money from the defense of that case. And Judge Rush then put Mr. Jenkel under oath as an officer of the court and asked him that question, and Mr. Jenkel replied no. This was a total frivolous expenditure, and frankly, for three attorneys having to come to a hearing, I think $350 is a pretty mild sanction, especially given Mr. Johnson's hourly rate. I have nothing further unless the court has some more questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Wilbur.
Thank you.
Ms. Allen, you have 10 minutes.
Now, I know you weren't there, but maybe you could fill me in.
I will.
On the relevance of an attorney that isn't even involved in this declaratory judgment action to show what?
Okay. So on the duty to defend. On the duty to defend, the governor said that he was one of the decision makers, one of three decision makers. When asked why he made that decision or made that decision to terminate their employment or wanted to have them brought to criminal action, but to deny the duty to defend or not get a defense cost on this, he talked about how he found their conduct offensive, mildly. That is the explanation. I think part of the deposition is in the brief. But basically that he was so offended by their conduct, that he was so offended by their callous disregard for the safety and health, that he did not want these employees defended on this matter. The reason that...
Well, now, let me ask you this as you're going, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I do. So that has got nothing to do with Johnson Heidemann to me.
Okay, if you follow it, does.
I'm having a hard time following it.
Okay, but if you're so offended by that conduct that you won't give the state's employees at least defense coverage on this matter, he certainly wasn't offended that his son's firm, and consequently probably his son, benefited by representing in that federal action where he didn't give attorney fees or made that decision that they wouldn't get attorney fees on the defense of Wegeman and Lane. Ettinger, Ramsey, and Johnson are all represented by the Johnson-Heideprim firm.
You can show that they're represented, and you can show that, but what difference does it make who they're represented by?
Well,
I'm having a hard time.
Because his son is in that firm.
It looks like trying to put a square peg into a round hole.
It's impeachment. If that's how offended you are, if I'm so offended by something, myself and mine don't benefit from it.
Okay, so
and these people were higher up, and they're all three defended by that firm. And again, this is discovery. Discovery is broad. The principles of discovery are broad. And there is nothing sacred about that partnership agreement, whether it's Johnson Heideprim's or anybody else's. There's nothing privileged about it, and there's nothing sacred about that. And you get something out of the partnership agreement. What Russ got, Russell Jenkel would have gotten.
Are you saying then that they paid that money to that firm, so there wasn't money to pay for your client's defense, or what?
I'm saying, maybe the reason, from the beginning, that this was scapegoating wasn't that you're so offended by these two people's conduct. It's scapegoating. If you're so offended, your son and his firm don't benefit from representing the people that are whose behavior is more offensive. On 58-12-3,
thank you.
58-12-3. That is a very broad statute, and if you look at the language, whether that one particular statute says this is not insurance, this court has said insurance coverage or principles of insurance apply. And I didn't mean to misrepresent that. I thought you were asking me how you interpreted it. I wasn't saying that the commissioner had considered it insurance or anything else. But this court has applied principles of insurance. If you look at the language of 58-12-3, it couldn't be broader. It says, in all actions or proceedings hereafter commenced against any employer who is self-insured or insurance company, including any reciprocal or insurance exchange, on any policy or certificate of any type or kind of insurance. If this is not any type or kind of insurance, what is this? If it's not, you know, self-insured, if it's not a type or kind of insurance, what is it? The legislature's known what your position was in the Winger case. The legislature knows what's in 58.12.3. If they wanted to exclude the People Fund, which if it looks like it, it smells like it, you apply those principles to it, this is broad enough. 58.12.3 is certainly broad enough to cover that People's Fund. Also, on the memorandum of coverage, if this is not, if there's no contract here, why does People Fund, and it's their document, they name it, why is it Memorandum of Liability Coverage to the Employees of the State of South Dakota? That is what it's called. That's what's attached to the brief. That's what it is. Whose benefit is for? And if they're just an uninterested party, or if this is nothing to them, why'd you bring them in this declaratory judgment action? Why were they brought in the declaratory judgment action? If it's just between you and the state, bring the state in. But she was brought into this action when she's trying to defend her termination, when she's trying to defend herself on four felony counts, now has a $100,000 lien against her, when she's trying to defend a several million dollar case in federal court. This is not some meaningless gratuity for those state employees, and they have as much right to pursue their rights under this memorandum of liability coverage to the employees of the state of South Dakota as anybody else in a group insurance coverage.
As a matter of fact, they were forced to because the People Fund brought the declaratory judgment action, right?
That's
if
right.
They had defaulted in it and just and let it go, then they'd have got a judgment that there was no coverage.
That is correct. That is correct. And that is
at what point in time did Judge Rush make the decision that there was coverage, that the suit had to be defended?
In March, at a hearing, March 29th. And that was well after the case had been dismissed.
March
29th
of 2001.
Right. And that was after it had been, I was trying to look that up, what the date was, but and it's in one of the attachments, I know that the order of dismissal and that the case had been settled for some time. And they still proceeded. They still resisted on summary judgment, and the decision doesn't come out, I think, until June 10th on that issue. So, you know, it went ahead. They were brought into this action and basically had to defend it. And that is one of the equities I want this court to consider. When you're looking at imposing terms against Mr. Aberesk, impeachment was important here. When someone's saying, why didn't we cover these two when we covered everybody else, what his motives were, what his stated motives were, to impeach that is very legitimate, especially when you're going under the theme, and I think a legitimate one, that it is scapegoating. That was clearly discoverable. This person took on these cases, the federal case, you don't know if you're going to get paid. This one, you don't know if you're going to get paid. And unless anyone thinks that it's better that these people go ahead and represent themselves or have a default judgment entered against them, that is an equity that should have been considered under the Crittenden criteria before you impose terms against someone on the very broad area of seeking discovery. I know that it's only $365, but it's somebody's career. Imposing terms against a lawyer, it affects you, and I think that is why the court in the Chittenden case said consider the equities, and I'm asking the court to do that.
Did you have to get a subpoena or a request information that says that these other people were defended, or was that just public knowledge?
You knew they were defended. What you didn't know, and again, it's a theme, if you're so offended, you want yourself, your family, to benefit from it. And he was looking one step further, what was the benefit? You can find out a lot of partnership agreement. You can find out how much expenses are paid. You can find out if there's a rainmaker fee. It may be an uncomfortable area of inquiry politically. It was a legitimate area of discovery. Impeachment is always a legitimate area of discovery for those reasons. The issue that was raised on the declaratory judgment action, there are specific provisions in that Declaratory Judgment Act, and again, I cited a Tenth Circuit case that said this goes beyond just the tort, and that is when I was asked, it's contract, it's 58.12.3, and if you look at a tort or bad faith in context of the Declaratory Judgment Act, that statute provides that it's to be remedial. That says it's to be liberally applied and administered. There's some meaning for that remedial, those remedial provisions. They are not without meaning. The legislature meant something with them, and they, again, as the Tenth Circuit has held in the case that was cited in the brief, they are a basis for basically for attorney fees in a declaratory judgment action. Otherwise, here she is. She's stuck defending this thing. There are significant defense costs in this, and it was necessary to be defended. From everything that's said today, I have no idea why you would bring it and expect this person not to defend the case, and they shouldn't have brought it. And there's another issue that basically you put her at risk. You did it to mess with her. You did it when there were all of these things going against her.
They'd already advised her that they were not going to cover her in the defense of the federal lawsuit. Right. Why did the declaratory judgment action take so long? It was started in November of 99. And you said it was resolved March 29th of 2001.
It's June of 2002 before the actual opinion comes out on whether or not that Exclusion 30 applied and whether they had a duty to defend. And then they were still...
I didn't understand what you said.
I think in June 10th was when there was a final decision on whether or not there was a duty to defend, and that was 2001. Yes. Mm-hmm. And then there were the terms were still out, the issues on terms and the issue on the attorney fees on the declaratory judgment action were still out. So it did take some time. But in any event, when you look at all of the factors, the contract, declaratory judgment provisions, and 58.12.3 in that very broad definition of any type or kind of insurance, and you look at that actual contract, who it was for, and how broadly they defined it, when they could have defined it narrowly what defense costs were and chose not to, there are very many good reasons to allow there should be attorney fees in this case. It's on the plate to make this person whole. And, again, I would ask that the court reverse that order imposing terms against Mr. Abrask.
Thank you, counsel.
Court will be in recess.